Non-experimental and experimental designs. Introduction to research designs. Understanding research design is fundamental to interpreting the validity and applicability of scientific studies. Non-experimental designs, such as correlational and quasi-experimental approaches, involve observation without direct manipulation of variables. These methods are instrumental when ethical, logistical, or practical limitations prevent experimental manipulation. For instance, a researcher might examine the relationship between socioeconomic status and academic achievement without altering participants' incomes or schooling environments. Non-experimental designs offer insight into relationships, but lack the ability to infer causation due to inherent limitations in controlling treatment conditions and extraneous variables. In contrast, experimental designs actively manipulate independent variables, treatments, to observe their effects on dependent variables, outcomes, allowing researchers to establish causal relationships. These designs require control and randomization to minimize the influence of extraneous factors. By implementing random assignment, researchers distribute participant characteristics evenly across conditions, enhancing internal validity. For example, an experiment investigating the impact of sleep on cognitive performance might randomly assign participants to different sleep durations, independent variables, and measure task accuracy, dependent variable. Experimental designs are often considered the gold standard for testing hypotheses due to their potential to draw causal inferences. That is, a conclusion that an independent variable caused a meaningful difference in a dependent variable. Both designs serve unique roles in the scientific process. While experimental studies provide robust evidence for causation, non-experimental designs often guide hypothesis generation and exploratory analysis. These approaches complement each other in building a comprehensive understanding of complex phenomena. However, researchers must remain vigilant about the limitations inherent in each method, ensuring findings are interpreted within their proper contexts. The choice between experimental and non-experimental designs depends on research objectives, ethical considerations, and available resources. The scientific method's flexibility enables researchers to adapt their designs to study specific questions effectively. Whether using non-experimental or experimental approaches, rigor in methodology and critical evaluation of results are crucial to advancing knowledge. A clear understanding of the strengths and weaknesses of both designs empowers researchers to craft studies that yield meaningful and actionable insights. Practitioners are better able to select assessment and training methods for their clients when they understand the science that underpins clinical tools and their use. Populations, samples, and random sampling. Central to any research endeavor is the selection of participants from a larger population. A population encompasses the entire group of individuals relevant to a study, while a sample is a subset of that population. For instance, in a study on high school students' sleep patterns, the population might include all high school students in a specific country, while the sample could consist of students from a few randomly selected schools. The process of sampling is crucial for ensuring that study findings are representative and generalizable, that is, applicable to clients whose characteristics resemble those of the population from which the experimental subjects were sampled. Random sampling is a method where every member of the population has an equal chance of being selected for the study. This technique minimizes selection bias and enhances external validity by producing a sample that reflects the diversity of the population. For example, a randomized selection of participants for a study on dietary habits ensures that factors such as age, gender, and socioeconomic status are proportionately represented. This broad representation allows researchers to generalize findings with greater confidence. One of the primary advantages of random sampling is its ability to reduce sampling error, the discrepancy between the characteristics of the sample and the population. By ensuring that the sample is not skewed towards specific subgroups, researchers can attribute observed effects to the variables under investigation rather than to sample peculiarities. Additionally, random sampling facilitates replication, as other researchers can recreate the study with different samples and verify the results. While random sampling is ideal, it is not always feasible due to practical constraints like time, cost, and access to the population. In such cases, Alternative methods like stratified sampling or convenience sampling may be employed, albeit with limitations. Regardless of the approach, researchers must acknowledge and address potential biases introduced during the sampling process to maintain the study's credibility. Independent, dependent, and extraneous variables. The foundation of experimental research lies in the identification and manipulation of variables. An independent variable, 4, represents the factor a researcher intentionally alters to observe its impact. For instance, in a study of neurofeedback, the 4 could be the type of feedback provided, such as auditory or visual. The dependent variable, DV, on the other hand, is the outcome being measured, such as changes in brainwave patterns or behavioral improvements. The relationship between the 4 and DV forms the core of experimental inquiry, with the DV's value hypothesized to depend on changes in the 4. Extraneous variables, EVs, are factors that might influence the DV but are not intentionally studied. For example, room temperature or participant mood could inadvertently affect performance in a cognitive task study. When EVs are not adequately controlled, they can lead to confounding, where the true relationship between the 4 and DV becomes obscured. A classic example is a study on the effects of exercise on weight loss, where dietary intake, an EV, could significantly alter outcomes if not accounted for. Effective research design strives to minimize the influence of EVs to maintain internal validity. Researchers employ various strategies to manage EVs, such as random assignment, matching participants on relevant characteristics, or holding conditions constant. These methods help isolate the IV's effects on the DV, enabling more precise conclusions. For instance, controlling for time of day in a memory experiment by using only one time of day for delivering the 4 and measuring the DV ensures that circadian variations do not confound results. Without such controls, differences in memory performance might be attributed to experimental conditions such as differences in timing that might make rather than physiological rhythms overshadow the memory related for being studied. Understanding the interplay of IVs, DVs, and EVs is essential for designing experiments and interpreting their findings. A nuanced appreciation of these elements allows researchers to critique studies rigorously and identify potential sources of bias or error. Whether evaluating published research or designing original studies, a strong grasp of variable management is indispensable to scientific integrity. Internal and external validity. Internal validity refers to the degree to which changes in the dependent variable can be attributed to the manipulation of the independent variable, free from confounding influences. Achieving high internal validity requires stringent control of extraneous variables, ensuring that observed effects are genuinely due to the experimental manipulation. For example, in a study testing the effects of a new educational intervention, internal validity would necessitate that differences in learning outcomes are not influenced by teacher expertise or classroom resources. External validity, conversely, addresses the generalizability of findings beyond the specific conditions of the study. A study with high external validity produces results that can be applied to diverse populations, settings, or variations of the treatment. For instance, an experiment demonstrating the effectiveness of a stress reduction technique among college students would have limited external validity if it could not be replicated in older adults or individuals in high-stress professions. Achieving external validity often involves using representative samples and conducting studies in real-world environments. Balancing internal and external validity is a common challenge in research. Experimental designs often prioritize internal validity through controlled settings, sometimes at the expense of external applicability. Conversely, non-experimental designs may enhance external validity by studying naturalistic phenomena, but struggle with confounding variables that threaten internal validity. Researchers must weigh these trade-offs based on their study's objectives and intended applications. Methodological innovations, such as field experiments or hybrid designs, aim to reconcile these tensions by combining rigorous control with ecological realism. For example, a randomized controlled trial conducted in a workplace setting might retain internal validity while offering greater external validity than a lab-based study. By critically considering the validity trade-offs, researchers can design studies that maximize the utility and credibility of their findings. Threats to internal validity. Internal validity can be compromised by various threats, each of which introduces alternative explanations for observed effects. One such threat is history, where events occurring outside the experiment influence the dependent variable. For example, a widespread news event might alter participants' stress levels during a study on relaxation techniques. Maturation poses another risk, as participants naturally change over time due to aging, learning, or fatigue, potentially confounding results in longitudinal research. Testing effects occur when prior exposure to a measurement influences subsequent performance. For instance, participants in a biofeedback study might improve over repeated sessions simply due to familiarity with the equipment rather than the intervention's efficacy. Instrumentation threats arise from changes in measurement tools or procedures, such as recalibrating a blood pressure cuff midway through a study, leading to inconsistent data. Other threats include statistical regression, assignment, and mortality. Statistical regression can skew results when participants are selected based on extreme scores, which naturally tend to move toward the mean over time. Improper assignment procedures, such as failing to randomize participants, can create unequal groups that confound outcomes. Mortality, or differential dropout rates between groups, undermines the comparability of conditions and complicates interpretation. Mitigating these threats requires meticulous planning and implementation of robust controls. Random assignment, blinding, subject and experimenter are unaware of which treatment they are receiving/administering, and the use of standardized protocols are vital tools for preserving internal validity. By addressing these threats proactively, researchers enhance the credibility and reliability of their findings, laying a solid foundation for scientific advancement. Control of physical, social, and participant variables. Controlling variables is a cornerstone of experimental design, ensuring that extraneous factors do not overshadow the relationship between the independent and dependent variables. Physical variables, such as room temperature, lighting, and noise levels, can be managed through elimination, constancy, or balancing. For example, conducting all sessions in a soundproof room eliminates noise as a confounding factor, while balancing schedules across morning and afternoon sessions distributes potential circadian effects. Social variables, including demand characteristics and experimenter bias, also require careful management. Demand characteristics are cues that signal expected behaviors to participants, potentially influencing their responses. For instance, if participants suspect they are being tested on attention, they may consciously alter their performance. Employing single or double-blind designs can mitigate these effects by concealing the study's purpose. Experimenter bias, where researchers inadvertently influence outcomes, can be controlled through training and automation of procedures. Participant characteristics, such as personality traits or baseline physiological states, pose additional challenges. Random assignment minimizes differences between groups, but matching techniques or within subject, repeated measurement of the same subject, designs can further ensure comparability. For example, in a study on mindfulness, researchers might match participants on baseline stress levels before assigning them to experimental or control groups. Such measures help isolate the intervention's true effects. Effective control of these variables enhances internal and external validity, creating a more reliable basis for interpreting results. By addressing the multifaceted nature of potential confounders, researchers uphold the rigor and credibility of their experimental designs, contributing to the robustness of scientific knowledge. Correlational studies. Correlational studies are a fundamental component of non-experimental research, offering a method to explore relationships between variables without manipulating them. These studies are particularly useful when ethical or practical constraints prevent experimental manipulation. For instance, researchers might examine the link between socioeconomic status and educational attainment without altering participants' financial situations. By observing naturally occurring associations, correlational studies provide valuable insights into how variables are interrelated within a population. However, it is essential to recognize that correlation does not imply causation. A significant correlation between two variables only indicates that they are related, not that one causes the other. For example, a positive correlation between exercise and mental health may suggest that individuals who exercise tend to have better mental health, but it does not reveal whether exercise improves mental health or whether mentally healthy individuals are more likely to exercise. This limitation is a critical consideration in interpreting findings from correlational studies. Despite these constraints, correlational research is a powerful tool for identifying potential causal relationships to be tested in experimental designs. It is also widely used in fields like epidemiology, psychology, and sociology, where variables of interest often cannot be ethically or feasibly manipulated. For example, examining the relationship between smoking and lung cancer initially relied on correlational studies before experimental evidence substantiated causality. Characteristics and uses of correlational studies. Correlational studies are characterized by their focus on measuring and analyzing the statistical relationship between two or more variables. The strength and direction of these relationships are quantified using correlation coefficients, such as Pearson's R, which ranges from -1 to +1. A value close to +1 indicates a strong positive relationship, where increases in one variable are associated with increases in the other. Conversely, a value near -1 represents a strong negative relationship, where increases in one variable correspond to decreases in the other. A value close to 0 suggests no significant relationship. One of the primary advantages of correlational studies is their ability to handle large datasets and complex variables. Researchers can examine relationships across diverse populations, settings, and conditions, generating results that are often more generalizable than those from highly controlled experimental studies. For instance, large-scale correlational research has been instrumental in understanding public health trends, such as the association between sedentary behavior and cardiovascular disease risk. Another strength lies in their applicability to exploratory research. Correlational studies help identify potential relationships that merit further investigation, guiding the development of hypotheses for experimental testing. This exploratory function is particularly valuable in new or poorly understood research areas, where establishing foundational knowledge is essential. Limitations of correlational studies. While correlational studies are highly informative, they are not without limitations. The most significant drawback is the inability to establish causation due to potential confounding variables. A confounding variable is an unmeasured factor that influences both variables of interest, creating a false appearance of a relationship. For example, the correlation between ice cream sales and drowning incidents may be explained by a third variable, hot weather, that drives both phenomena. Another limitation is the problem of directionality. Correlation does not indicate which variable influences the other. In a study linking sleep quality and academic performance, it is unclear whether better sleep leads to improved grades or whether academic stress affects sleep patterns. This ambiguity often necessitates follow-up experimental studies to clarify causal pathways. Despite these challenges, researchers can mitigate some issues by carefully selecting variables, controlling for potential confounders, and employing advanced statistical techniques like partial correlation and structural equation modeling. These approaches enhance the robustness and interpretability of correlational findings, allowing researchers to draw more nuanced conclusions. Applications in specific fields. Correlational studies are widely used across scientific disciplines due to their flexibility and practicality. In psychology, they help explore complex human behaviors and mental processes. For instance, researchers have investigated correlations between personality traits and job satisfaction, providing valuable insights for organizational development and employee well-being. In public health, correlational research plays a critical role in identifying risk factors for diseases. Studies examining the relationship between dietary habits and chronic conditions like diabetes or obesity inform preventative strategies and public health policies. These insights often serve as a foundation for more targeted experimental interventions. Sociology also benefits from correlational studies, particularly in understanding societal trends and inequalities. For example, studies examining the correlation between education levels and income disparities highlight systemic issues that can inform policymaking and social reform efforts. By revealing patterns and associations, correlational research contributes to evidence-based decision-making in diverse contexts. Techniques for data collection. The quality of a correlational study depends heavily on its data collection methods. Surveys and questionnaires are among the most common tools, allowing researchers to gather large amounts of data efficiently. However, the reliability of these methods depends on the validity of the instruments used and the honesty of respondents. For example, self-reported data on exercise habits may be prone to social desirability bias, where participants overreport positive behaviors. Observational studies are another common approach, where researchers record variables in their natural settings without interference. For instance, a study examining the correlation between playground activity and childhood obesity might involve observing children's behaviors in schoolyards. These methods provide valuable ecological validity, but require careful control to avoid observer bias. Technological advances have expanded data collection possibilities in correlational research. Wearable devices, mobile apps, and online platforms enable the collection of real-time data on diverse variables, from physical activity levels to social media usage. These innovations enhance the precision and scope of correlational studies, offering unprecedented opportunities for exploring relationships in dynamic and complex systems. Advanced statistical approaches. Analyzing data from correlational studies often involves more than calculating simple correlation coefficients. Partial correlation, for instance, measures the relationship between two variables while controlling for the influence of a third variable. This technique helps address confounding issues and provides a clearer picture of the direct relationship between variables. Regression analysis is another powerful tool, allowing researchers to model and predict relationships. For example, multiple regression can identify how several independent variables, such as age, income, and education, collectively influence a dependent variable like health outcomes. Structural equation modeling, SEM, takes this a step further, enabling researchers to test complex theoretical models that include multiple relationships and mediating variables. These advanced methods increase the rigor of correlational studies, ensuring findings are robust and meaningful. However, they also require careful interpretation and transparency, as overly complex models can obscure rather than clarify relationships if not appropriately validated. Ethical considerations. Ethical considerations are paramount in correlational studies, particularly when sensitive variables are involved. Researchers must ensure participant confidentiality and obtain informed consent, especially when dealing with personal data like health records or psychological assessments. For example, a study exploring the correlation between mental health symptoms and social media use must handle data with care to avoid stigmatization or breaches of privacy. Additionally, correlational findings can have unintended societal implications. Misinterpreting or overgeneralizing results may reinforce stereotypes or lead to flawed policy decisions. Researchers have a responsibility to present findings accurately and emphasize their limitations, ensuring stakeholders understand the context and nuances of the data. Conclusion: correlational studies are invaluable in advancing scientific understanding, offering a means to explore relationships between variables in diverse contexts. While they cannot establish causation, their ability to generate hypotheses, inform experimental designs, and guide decision-making makes them a cornerstone of empirical research. By employing rigorous methods and addressing inherent limitations, researchers can harness the full potential of correlational studies to contribute meaningfully to knowledge and practice across disciplines. Common quasi-experimental designs. Quasi-experimental designs are essential tools in research when true experimental designs are not feasible due to ethical, logistical, or practical constraints. Unlike experimental designs, quasi-experiments do not rely on random assignment to allocate participants to different groups or conditions. This lack of randomization differentiates them and poses unique challenges and benefits. Despite these limitations, quasi-experimental designs offer valuable insights, especially in real-world settings where manipulating variables is not possible. For instance, a study evaluating the impact of a public health campaign on smoking cessation cannot ethically or practically assign participants to smoking or non-smoking groups. Quasi-experimental designs are particularly useful for evaluating interventions, policies, or programs. They allow researchers to examine cause and effect relationships by comparing outcomes before and after an intervention or between groups exposed to different conditions. However, the absence of random assignment increases the risk of confounding variables influencing the results. Researchers must use careful design and statistical controls to mitigate these risks and strengthen the validity of their findings. Understanding common quasi-experimental designs and their applications provides researchers with a robust framework to investigate questions that would otherwise remain unanswered. These designs bridge the gap between purely observational studies and true experiments, making them invaluable in fields such as education, public health, and social sciences. Pretest/post-test designs. One of the most frequently used quasi-experimental designs is the pretest/post-test design. In this approach, researchers measure a dependent variable before and after introducing an intervention or treatment. This design is straightforward and widely applicable, making it a popular choice for evaluating changes over time. For example, a school might implement a new reading program and assess students' reading skills before and after the program's implementation. Despite its simplicity, the pretest/post-test design has notable limitations. Changes in the dependent variable may not solely result from the intervention, but could be influenced by external factors, such as maturation, history, or testing effects. For instance, students' reading skills may naturally improve over time or due to increased familiarity with the assessment tools rather than the program itself. To address these issues, researchers often include additional design elements, such as control groups or statistical adjustments. A variation of this design, the pretest/post-test control group design, incorporates a comparison group that does not receive the intervention. This addition helps to account for external factors and enhances the internal validity of the study. For example, comparing reading improvements in a group exposed to the program with those in a similar group not exposed can provide stronger evidence for the program's effectiveness. Ex post facto designs. Ex post facto designs, or after-the-fact studies, involve analyzing relationships between variables after the conditions of the study have already occurred. This design is particularly useful when researchers cannot manipulate variables or assign participants to conditions. For instance, a study examining the effects of prenatal smoking on child development must rely on naturally occurring groups of mothers who did or did not smoke during pregnancy. One of the strengths of ex post facto designs is their ability to address research questions that are otherwise ethically or practically unapproachable. However, the lack of control over variable random assignment increases susceptibility to confounding variables. For example, mothers who smoke during pregnancy may differ in other ways, such as socioeconomic status or access to healthcare, which could also impact child development outcomes. Researchers often use statistical techniques to control for these confounding factors, such as matching participants on key characteristics or using regression analysis to isolate the effect of the variable of interest. While these approaches enhance the validity of ex post facto studies, they cannot completely eliminate the limitations inherent in the design. Advantages and limitations of quasi-experimental designs. Quasi-experimental designs offer several advantages that make them indispensable in applied research. First, they allow researchers to study interventions and treatments in naturalistic settings, enhancing the ecological validity of the findings. For example, evaluating the effectiveness of a workplace wellness program in a real-world corporate environment provides insights that are directly applicable to similar settings. Second, these designs are often more feasible and ethical than true experiments. In many cases, random assignment is either impossible or inappropriate, such as when studying the effects of educational policies on student outcomes. Quasi-experimental designs provide a practical alternative that respects ethical considerations while still yielding valuable data. However, these benefits come with significant limitations. The primary drawback is the increased vulnerability to confounding variables and threats to internal validity. Without randomization, it is challenging to ensure that groups are comparable at the outset of the study, making it difficult to attribute observed differences to the intervention. Researchers must carefully consider these limitations when designing studies and interpreting their results. Addressing internal validity in quasi-experimental designs. To improve the internal validity of quasi-experimental designs, researchers employ various strategies. One common approach is the use of match groups, where participants in the treatment and comparison groups are paired based on similar characteristics. For example, in a study evaluating a new teaching method, researchers might match students on prior academic performance, age, and socioeconomic status. Another strategy is incorporating statistical controls to account for confounding variables. Techniques such as analysis of covariance, ANCOVA, or propensity score matching can help isolate the effect of the intervention by controlling for differences between groups. These methods enhance the interpretability of the results, but require careful application and a thorough understanding of the data. Interrupted time series designs offer another solution, especially in cases where repeated measurements of the dependent variable are available. By analyzing trends before and after the intervention, researchers can detect whether changes are likely due to the treatment or other factors. For instance, tracking crime rates before and after implementing a new policing strategy provides a clearer picture of its impact. Applications across disciplines. Quasi-experimental designs are widely used across various fields, reflecting their versatility and practicality. In education, they are commonly employed to evaluate programs and policies. For instance, a quasi-experimental study might assess the effectiveness of a new curriculum by comparing student performance in schools that adopt the curriculum versus those that do not. In public health, quasi-experimental designs help evaluate interventions aimed at improving community health outcomes. Studies examining the impact of vaccination campaigns, anti-smoking initiatives, or nutrition programs often rely on these designs due to the challenges of randomizing participants in large-scale settings. For example, comparing regions with and without a public health campaign can reveal its effectiveness in reducing disease prevalence. Social sciences also benefit from quasi-experimental approaches, particularly in evaluating policies and social programs. For instance, researchers might study the effects of housing assistance programs on homelessness rates by comparing outcomes in communities with differing levels of program implementation. These designs provide critical insights that inform policy decisions and resource allocation. Conclusion: quasi-experimental designs occupy a vital space in research methodology, offering practical solutions for investigating cause-and-effect relationships in real-world settings. While they lack the rigor of true experiments, their flexibility and applicability make them invaluable for addressing complex questions in diverse disciplines. By understanding their strengths and limitations, and by employing strategies to enhance validity, researchers can effectively leverage quasi-experimental designs to generate meaningful and actionable insights. Randomized Controlled Trials, RCTs. Randomized Controlled Trials, RCTs, are widely regarded as the gold standard in efficacy research due to their unparalleled ability to establish causal relationships. The defining feature of an RCT is the random assignment of participants to different conditions, such as treatment or control groups. This randomization process ensures that participant characteristics are evenly distributed across groups, minimizing the risk of confounding variables and enhancing internal validity. For instance, in a study evaluating the effectiveness of a new drug, randomization ensures that differences in age, gender, or health status between groups do not skew the results. RCTs are used across disciplines, including medicine, psychology, and education, to test interventions, treatments, and policies. By comparing outcomes between experimental and control conditions, researchers can determine whether an intervention produces a statistically significant and clinically meaningful effect. For example, an RCT might assess whether a cognitive behavioral therapy program reduces symptoms of depression more effectively than a placebo or alternative therapy. The strength of RCTs lies in their rigorous design, which prioritizes control and precision. By isolating the independent variable, the treatment or intervention, and systematically measuring its impact on dependent variables, RCTs provide robust evidence for causation. Moreover, their structured approach facilitates replication and generalization, making them a cornerstone of evidence-based practice. Additionally, evidence-based practice in biofeedback and neurofeedback ratings require RCT evidence in order to classify applications as efficacious, level 4, or efficacious and specific, level 5. These classifications underscore the importance of RCTs in validating interventions for clinical use. The Brady Executive Monkey Study. One of the most notable studies, often misinterpreted as an RCT, is the Brady Executive Monkey Experiment conducted in the 1950s. This study examined the effects of executive responsibility on stress and illness. Brady assigned rhesus monkeys to two groups: an executive group, which had control over avoiding shocks by pressing a lever, and a yoke control group, which received the same shocks but had no control over their administration. The critical flaw in Brady's study was his method of assigning monkeys to groups. Instead of randomizing, he deliberately assigned the twitchiest monkeys, those most responsive to stress, to the executive condition. This biased assignment introduced a major confounding variable: the inherent stress sensitivity of the executive monkeys. As a result, Brady observed that the executive monkeys developed ulcers, leading to the conclusion that executive responsibility itself causes stress-related illness. This conclusion was misleading and contradicted by later research. Weiss, 1972, replicated the experiment with proper random assignment and found the opposite results. Weiss demonstrated that lack of control, rather than executive responsibility, was more detrimental to health. His findings highlighted the protective effects of perceived control in stressful situations, a concept widely supported in organizational and health psychology. Brady's study also suffered from small sample sizes, which limited its statistical power and external validity. Small samples increased the likelihood of random error and reduced the generalizability of findings. In Brady's case, the small sample exaggerated the apparent effects of stress in the executive condition, further skewing interpretations. These methodological flaws underline the importance of randomization and adequate sample sizes in RCTs to ensure valid and reliable conclusions. Unfortunately, Brady's study perpetuated the false belief that executive responsibility inherently leads to stress and illness. This misconception influenced organizational policies and public perceptions for years. The enduring legacy of this flawed research underscores the necessity of rigorous methodology in producing credible scientific evidence. Key features of RCTs. The hallmark of an RCT is its methodological rigor, which includes several critical features. Randomization is perhaps the most important, as it eliminates selection bias and ensures that groups are comparable at baseline. This process can be achieved through techniques like simple random sampling, stratified randomization, or block randomization. For example, in a study on blood pressure medications, stratified randomization might be used to ensure that participants with similar baseline blood pressure levels are evenly distributed across groups. Another key feature is the inclusion of a control group, which serves as a benchmark for comparison. Control groups may receive no treatment, a placebo, or an alternative intervention. For instance, a study on mindfulness meditation might compare outcomes in a meditation group, a relaxation group, and a no-treatment control group. This design helps isolate the specific effects of the intervention being tested. Blinding is also integral to RCTs, as it reduces bias in data collection and analysis. Single-blind designs conceal treatment allocation from participants, while double-blind designs extend this concealment to researchers. For example, in a drug trial, neither participants nor researchers would know who received the active drug versus a placebo, reducing the risk of expectancy effects. Replication and standardization further strengthen RCTs. Researchers follow detailed protocols to ensure consistency across study sites and participants, enabling reliable comparisons. For instance, in a multi-site study on exercise interventions for diabetes management, all sites would use the same exercise regimen and data collection methods. Such standardization enhances the reliability and generalizability of findings. The importance of randomization. Randomization is the foundation of RCTs, providing a mechanism to control for both known and unknown confounding variables. By assigning participants to groups purely by chance, randomization ensures that differences in outcomes can be attributed to the intervention rather than extraneous factors. For example, in a study on dietary supplements, randomization helps balance factors like baseline nutritional status and physical activity levels across groups. Randomization also facilitates statistical analysis, as it allows researchers to assume that any differences between groups at baseline are due to chance. This assumption simplifies the interpretation of results and strengthens causal inferences. For instance, If a randomized trial finds that a new weight loss program significantly reduces body mass index compared to a control group, researchers can confidently attribute the effect to the program. Despite its strengths, randomization must be carefully implemented to avoid bias. Methods like computer-generated random numbers or sealed envelopes ensure the integrity of the process. Moreover, maintaining allocation concealment prevents researchers and participants from knowing group assignments during the randomization process is crucial to minimizing selection bias. For example, in a trial on smoking cessation programs, allocation concealment prevents researchers from assigning highly motivated participants to the intervention group. Challenges in RCT implementation. While RCTs are the gold standard, they are not without challenges. One major issue is the cost and complexity of conducting large-scale trials. Recruiting participants, maintaining adherence to protocols, and managing extensive data collection requires significant resources. For instance, a multinational RCT on a new cancer treatment might involve thousands of participants, multiple sites, and years of follow-up. Ethical considerations also pose challenges, particularly in withholding potentially beneficial treatments from control groups. In such cases, researchers may use alternative designs, such as waitlist controls or crossover designs, to balance ethical concerns with scientific rigor. For example, in a study on a new vaccine, participants in the control group might receive the vaccine after the study's initial phase. Another challenge is ensuring participant retention and adherence. Dropouts and noncompliance can compromise the validity of RCTs, introducing bias and reducing statistical power. Strategies like regular follow-ups, incentives, and clear communication help mitigate these issues. For example, a trial on physical therapy for chronic pain might use weekly check-ins to encourage adherence and address barriers to participation. Applications and impact of RCTs. RCTs have had a profound impact on science and society, shaping evidence-based practices across fields. In medicine, they underpin the development and approval of new drugs, vaccines, and surgical techniques. For example, the rapid development of COVID-19 vaccines was made possible by large-scale RCTs demonstrating their safety and efficacy. In psychology, RCTs validate therapeutic interventions, such as cognitive behavioral therapy for anxiety disorders. These trials not only confirm efficacy, but also inform best practices for implementation. For instance, an RCT comparing online and in-person therapy formats might reveal insights into accessibility and effectiveness. Education and public policy also benefit from RCTs. Studies on early childhood education programs, for example, have demonstrated their long-term benefits for academic achievement and social outcomes. Similarly, RCTs evaluating economic policies, such as universal basic income pilots, provide robust evidence to guide decision-making. Limitations of RCTs. Despite their strengths, RCTs have limitations that warrant consideration. One major limitation is the lack of generalizability in highly controlled settings. Findings from a tightly controlled trial may not translate to real-world conditions. For example, a study on exercise programs conducted in a clinical setting may not reflect the challenges individuals face in adopting these routines in everyday life. Another limitation is the ethical and practical constraints of randomization. In some cases, withholding treatment from control groups or randomizing participants to harmful conditions is unethical. Researchers must navigate these challenges carefully, balancing scientific rigor with ethical responsibility. Finally, RCTs often require long timelines and significant resources, making them inaccessible for some research questions. For instance, a study on the long-term effects of a dietary intervention may take decades to complete, delaying the availability of actionable insights. Researchers must weigh these trade-offs when designing studies and interpreting results. Conclusion: Why RCTs are the gold standard? RCTs are the gold standard for efficacy research because they provide the most reliable method for establishing causation. Through randomization, control groups, and blinding, RCTs minimize bias and confounding, producing robust and reproducible results. Their rigorous methodology has transformed fields ranging from medicine to education, setting the foundation for evidence-based practice. However, RCTs are not without challenges, including ethical considerations, high costs, and generalizability issues. By addressing these limitations and combining RCTs with other research methods, scientists can build a comprehensive understanding of complex phenomena. Ultimately, the strength of RCTs lies in their ability to produce credible and actionable insights, making them an indispensable tool in advancing knowledge and improving outcomes. The reliance on RCT evidence for classifications such as efficacious and efficacious and specific in evidence-based practice in biofeedback and neurofeedback further underscores their critical role in validating interventions for clinical and practical use. Specific and nonspecific treatment effects. In clinical and research contexts, treatment effects are typically categorized into specific and nonspecific effects. Specific treatment effects are directly attributable to the mechanisms of the intervention, while nonspecific effects arise from factors unrelated to the specific therapeutic components, such as the placebo effect, patient expectations, or the therapeutic alliance. Understanding the interplay between these effects is critical in interpreting research findings and optimizing clinical outcomes. Specific treatment effects represent the measurable outcomes produced by an intervention's active components. For example, in neurofeedback therapy, specific effects stem from operant conditioning of brainwave patterns, where participants learn to self-regulate neural activity. The efficacy of neurofeedback is often evaluated by measuring changes in targeted brainwave frequencies and associated improvements in symptoms. Conversely, nonspecific treatment effects are those that contribute to the overall therapeutic outcome, but are not tied to the intervention's active components. In neurofeedback, nonspecific effects may include the patient's belief in the treatment's efficacy, the structured nature of the sessions, or the supportive relationship with the therapist. These effects are not unique to neurofeedback and can be observed across various therapeutic modalities. The distinction between specific and nonspecific effects is vital for research design and clinical application. In neurofeedback research, identifying specific effects requires rigorous control conditions, such as sham feedback or placebo interventions, to isolate the active components of the therapy. By doing so, researchers can determine whether observed benefits are due to the specific mechanisms of neurofeedback or general therapeutic factor. Specific treatment effects. Specific treatment effects are central to evaluating the efficacy of any therapeutic intervention. In neurofeedback, these effects result from the direct training of brainwave patterns. For instance, in treating attention deficit/hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, neurofeedback protocols targeting beta waves aim to enhance sustained attention and reduce impulsivity. Specific effects are demonstrated through measurable changes in EEG patterns and corresponding behavioral improvements. The importance of specific effects lies in their ability to establish the scientific basis of an intervention. In neurofeedback research, demonstrating specific effects validates the theoretical framework underpinning the therapy and distinguishes it from nonspecific factors. For example, studies that compare active neurofeedback protocols to sham feedback can provide evidence for the unique contributions of brainwave training to therapeutic outcomes. Specific effects also guide protocol development and personalization in clinical practice. By understanding the neurophysiological mechanisms underlying specific effects, clinicians can tailor neurofeedback protocols to individual patients. For instance, patients with anxiety may benefit from protocols that increase alpha-theta ratios, while those with depression might respond to protocols enhancing left-right frontal alpha asymmetry. This precision enhances treatment efficacy and reduces variability in outcomes. In addition, specific effects are critical for gaining regulatory approval and establishing neurofeedback as an evidence-based treatment. Randomized controlled trials, RCTs, are the gold standard for demonstrating specific effects, as they control for nonspecific factors and provide robust evidence for causation. Regulatory bodies and professional organizations often require evidence of specific effects to classify interventions as efficacious or efficacious and specific. Nonspecific treatment effects. Nonspecific treatment effects play a significant role in therapeutic outcomes and are often intertwined with the overall efficacy of an intervention. In neurofeedback, nonspecific effects may include the structure and regularity of therapy sessions, the therapeutic relationship and the patient's expectations of improvement. These effects are not unique to neurofeedback and can enhance outcomes across a range of therapeutic modalities. One of the most well-known nonspecific effects is the placebo effect, where a patient's belief in the efficacy of a treatment contributes to positive outcomes. In neurofeedback, the placebo effect might arise from the patient's perception of advanced technology or the therapist's confidence in the intervention. While the placebo effect does not detract from the therapeutic value of neurofeedback, it highlights the need for rigorous controls and research to separate nonspecific effects from specific ones. Nonspecific effects also include factors such as the supportive environment of therapy and the therapist's communication style. These elements foster a sense of safety and trust, which can enhance patient engagement and adherence to the treatment process. For example, a neurofeedback therapist who provides clear explanations and empathetic support may increase a patient's motivation to participate actively in sessions, thereby improving outcomes. While nonspecific effects are valuable in enhancing overall therapeutic outcomes, they pose challenges in efficacy research. Without proper controls, nonspecific factors can confound study results, making it difficult to attribute improvements to the specific mechanisms of neurofeedback. For instance, a study lacking a sham feedback condition might overestimate the efficacy of neurofeedback due to the influence of patient expectations or the therapeutic alliance. The interplay of specific and nonspecific effects in neurofeedback research. In neurofeedback research, the interplay between specific and nonspecific effects is a critical consideration. Both types of effects contribute to therapeutic outcomes, but distinguishing between them is essential for advancing the field. Rigorous study designs, such as double-blind RCTs, are necessary to isolate specific effects while accounting for nonspecific factors. Sham feedback conditions are commonly used to differentiate specific effects from nonspecific ones. In these studies, participants in the sham condition receive feedback unrelated to their brain activity, while those in the active condition receive feedback based on real-time EEG signals. By comparing outcomes between groups, researchers can determine whether improvements are attributable to the specific mechanisms of neurofeedback or to general therapeutic factors. The distinction between specific and nonspecific effects also informs the interpretation of meta-analyses and systematic reviews in neurofeedback research. Studies that fail to control for nonspecific effects may overestimate the efficacy of neurofeedback, leading to inflated conclusions about its effectiveness. Conversely, studies that rigorously account for nonspecific factors provide more accurate and reliable evidence for the field. Understanding the interplay of specific and nonspecific effects also has implications for clinical practice. While specific effects are essential for validating neurofeedback as an evidence-based treatment, nonspecific effects enhance patient engagement and satisfaction. Clinicians can leverage nonspecific factors, such as building a strong therapeutic alliance, to optimize treatment outcomes while maintaining a focus on the intervention's active components. Conclusion: specific and nonspecific treatment effects are integral to understanding and optimizing therapeutic outcomes in neurofeedback. Specific effects validate the theoretical basis of neurofeedback and provide evidence for its efficacy, while nonspecific effects enhance patient engagement and satisfaction. In research, distinguishing between these effects is essential for advancing the field and establishing neurofeedback as an evidence-based intervention. Rigorous study designs, such as RCTs with sham feedback conditions, are necessary to isolate specific effects and control for nonspecific factors. These methodologies ensure the reliability and validity of research findings, contributing to the development of targeted and effective neurofeedback protocols. Clinically, acknowledging the role of nonspecific effects can enhance therapeutic outcomes by fostering a supportive and engaging treatment environment. Questionable research practices. Questionable research practices, QRPs, undermine the integrity of scientific research by compromising the validity and reliability of study findings. These practices include selective reporting, p-hacking, failure to publish null results, and a lack of transparency in data and methods. In neurofeedback research, QRPs can significantly distort our understanding of the field, leading to inflated efficacy claims and misguided clinical applications. Addressing these issues is essential for advancing neurofeedback as a rigorous and evidence-based discipline. The consequences of QRPs extend beyond individual studies. They erode trust in scientific findings, misinform clinicians and policymakers, and divert resources toward ineffective or unproven interventions. For example, if neurofeedback researchers selectively report only positive results, the perceived efficacy of certain protocols may be exaggerated, leading to inappropriate clinical adoption. Understanding and addressing QRPs is thus critical for ensuring the credibility and utility of neurofeedback research. In this lecture, we will examine key QRPs, discussing their manifestations, implications, and strategies for mitigation. By focusing on neurofeedback, we aim to highlight how these practices can skew the evidence base and propose solutions for fostering transparency and rigor in the field. The following discussion examines key QRPs, along with their manifestations, implications, and strategies for mitigation. With a focus on neurofeedback, the section below highlights examples of how QRPs can skew that field's evidence base and proposes solutions that foster transparency and rigor. Selective reporting. Selective reporting involves publishing only those findings that align with hypotheses or are deemed significant, while omitting or downplaying null or negative results. This practice creates a skewed literature where interventions appear more effective than they are. In neurofeedback research, selective reporting can lead to overestimated efficacy for specific protocols, such as those targeting attention deficit/hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, or anxiety. For instance, a neurofeedback study may explore multiple outcome measures, such as changes in EEG patterns, behavioral improvements, and subjective reports. If only the significant changes in EEG patterns are reported, while null results for behavior and subjective outcomes are omitted, the study presents an incomplete and biased view of the intervention's effectiveness. This selective emphasis distorts the scientific narrative and misguides clinicians seeking evidence-based treatments. Mitigating selective reporting requires pre-registration of study protocols, where researchers specify their hypotheses, methods, and planned analyses before data collection begins. Pre-registration ensures that all planned outcomes are reported, regardless of their statistical significance. In neurofeedback, pre-registering outcomes such as changes in specific brainwave frequencies and corresponding behavioral measures promotes transparency and accountability. Journals also play a critical role in combating selective reporting by encouraging or requiring the submission of pre-registered studies and publishing null results. Platforms like the Open Science Framework facilitate pre-registration and open sharing of data and methods, fostering a culture of transparency in neurofeedback research. P-hacking. P-hacking refers to manipulating data analyses to achieve statistically significant results, often through selective inclusion of variables, post hoc subgroup analyses, or iterative testing of statistical models. In neurofeedback research, p-hacking might involve adjusting inclusion criteria or reanalyzing data to highlight significant changes in EEG patterns or behavioral outcomes. For example, a neurofeedback study targeting anxiety might test multiple EEG frequencies, such as alpha, beta, and theta, for significant changes. If only the significant results for alpha waves are reported, while ignoring null findings for beta and theta waves, the study overstates the protocol's efficacy. This practice not only misrepresents the data, but also undermines the credibility of the field. Addressing p-hacking requires adherence to pre-registered analysis plans and the use of robust statistical methods. Transparency in reporting all tested variables and analyses, regardless of significance, is essential. Researchers can also adopt exploratory data analysis frameworks that clearly distinguish between hypothesis-driven and exploratory findings, ensuring that p-hacking does not masquerade as valid science. Journals and peer reviewers must critically evaluate submissions for signs of p-hacking and promote practices like registered reports, where the study's methods and analysis plans are reviewed and accepted before data collection. These measures reduce incentives for p-hacking and enhance the reliability of neurofeedback research. Failure to publish null results. The failure to publish null results creates a publication bias, where the scientific literature disproportionately features positive findings. In neurofeedback research, this bias can inflate the perceived efficacy of interventions, leading to unrealistic expectations and clinical practices based on incomplete evidence. For instance, if studies investigating a specific neurofeedback protocol for ADHD consistently fail to find significant effects but remain unpublished, the literature will only reflect positive findings. This selective publication skews meta-analyses and systematic reviews, presenting an overly optimistic view of the protocol's effectiveness. Promoting the publication of null results requires cultural and structural changes in academic publishing. Journals must prioritize scientific rigor over novelty, recognizing the value of null findings in advancing knowledge and preventing resource waste. For neurofeedback, null results can reveal limitations in existing protocols, guiding researchers toward more effective approaches. Platforms like preprint repositories and data sharing initiatives enable researchers to disseminate null findings and raw data, ensuring that all evidence contributes to the collective understanding of neurofeedback. By embracing the publication of null results, the field can build a more accurate and reliable evidence base. Lack of transparency. Transparency in data, methods, and reporting is fundamental to the integrity of scientific research. In neurofeedback, a lack of transparency can obscure methodological details, limit reproducibility, and hinder the evaluation of study quality. For example, if a study does not provide sufficient information about EEG recording parameters, protocol specifics, or participant characteristics, readers cannot fully assess its validity or replicate its findings. Hypothesizing after results are known, harking, occurs when researchers formulate or adjust their hypotheses based on the results of their study, rather than stating them a priori. This practice undermines the scientific process, as it transforms exploratory findings into seemingly confirmatory ones, misleading readers and overstating the robustness of the conclusions. In neurofeedback research, harking might involve claiming that a specific brainwave protocol was hypothesized to be effective only after the results indicate a significant effect. For example, a study on neurofeedback for anxiety might analyze data across multiple brainwave protocols. If significant changes are observed in theta wave activity, the researchers might retroactively claim they had hypothesized the theta wave protocol's efficacy from the outset. Such practices distort the research narrative, giving undue weight to post-hoc findings and eroding the integrity of the scientific literature. Combating harking requires a commitment to pre-registration and open science. Pre-registration involves publicly declaring study hypotheses, methods, and planned analyses before data collection begins. By committing to a pre-registered protocol, researchers can ensure that their hypotheses remain independent of their findings. In neurofeedback, pre-registering specific brainwave protocols and expected outcomes protects against post-hoc adjustments that compromise scientific rigor. Open science initiatives further mitigate harking by promoting transparency in research processes. Platforms like the Open Science Framework enable researchers to share their pre-registered protocols, raw data, and analysis scripts, fostering accountability and reproducibility. In neurofeedback, sharing detailed protocols and data allows other researchers to independently verify findings and evaluate whether reported hypotheses align with pre-registered ones. Harking also underscores the importance of distinguishing between exploratory and confirmatory research. While exploratory studies are valuable for generating new hypotheses, they must be presented as such rather than as confirmatory evidence. Journals and peer reviewers play a critical role in ensuring that studies clearly label exploratory analyses and avoid conflating them with pre-registered hypotheses. By addressing harking, the neurofeedback field can enhance the validity and reliability of its evidence base, supporting its growth as a scientifically rigorous discipline. Descriptive and inferential statistics. Descriptive and inferential statistics are fundamental tools in research, enabling scientists to summarize, interpret, and draw conclusions from data. Descriptive statistics provide a snapshot of the data by summarizing its main characteristics, while inferential statistics allow researchers to make predictions or generalizations about a larger population based on sample data. In neurofeedback research, both types of statistics play crucial roles in understanding and validating the effects of interventions. For example, Descriptive statistics might summarize the EEG activity of a group of patients undergoing neurofeedback, highlighting average changes in brainwave frequencies and their variability. Inferential statistics, on the other hand, can test hypotheses about the efficacy of neurofeedback protocols, such as determining whether observed changes in brainwave patterns are statistically significant across a larger population. Understanding and correctly applying these statistical tools is essential for designing robust studies, interpreting results accurately, and advancing evidence-based practice in neurofeedback. This lecture will explore the key measures of central tendency and variability within descriptive statistics, followed by an examination of inferential statistical methods, using neurofeedback research examples to illustrate their application. Measures of central tendency. Central tendency refers to the statistical measures that summarize and describe the center or typical value of a data set. The three primary measures of central tendency are the mean, median, and mode. Each provides unique insights into the data and is suited to different types of analysis. Mean. The mean, or average, is calculated by summing all values in a data set and dividing by the total number of observations. It is the most commonly used measure of central tendency and provides a straightforward way to describe the central value of a data set. In neurofeedback research, the mean might represent the average reduction in anxiety scores after a series of training sessions. However, the mean is sensitive to outliers, which can skew its value. For example, if one participant in a neurofeedback study shows an unusually large improvement in anxiety levels compared to others, the mean might overestimate the overall effect. Researchers must be cautious when interpreting the mean, especially in datasets with extreme values. Median. The median is the middle value in a dataset when the values are arranged in ascending or descending order, with half of the values on either side of the median. It is less affected by outliers and provides a robust measure of central tendency for skewed distributions. For instance, in a neurofeedback study examining changes in sleep quality, the median might more accurately represent the typical improvement if a few participants experience extreme changes. The median is particularly useful when the data include non-normally distributed values. For example, if most participants in a neurofeedback study show small improvements in attention, but a few demonstrate large gains, the median would offer a more representative measure of central tendency than the mean. Mode. The mode is the value that occurs most frequently in a data set. While it is less commonly used in research compared to the mean and median, the mode can be valuable for categorical or discrete data. In neurofeedback research, the mode might indicate the most common brainwave frequency targeted in a specific protocol. For example, if a study involves neurofeedback training targeting alpha, beta, and theta waves, the mode could identify which frequency is most frequently used across participants. The mode is also useful for identifying patterns in datasets, such as the most common response category in a patient satisfaction survey. Measures of variability. Variability measures describe the spread or dispersion of data within a dataset. Understanding variability is essential for interpreting central tendency and assessing the reliability of findings. The key measures of variability include range, variance, standard deviation, and interquartile range. Range. The range is the simplest measure of variability, calculated as the difference between the highest and lowest values in a dataset. It provides a quick sense of the spread of the data, but does not account for how values are distributed between the extremes. In neurofeedback research, the range might describe the span of anxiety score reductions across participants. For example, if the largest reduction in anxiety scores is 15 points and the smallest is 2 points, the range would be 13 points. While informative, the range does not provide insights into the consistency of the effects across participants and is highly sensitive to outliers. Variance. The variance measures the average squared deviation of each data point from the mean. It provides a more comprehensive assessment of variability than the range, but is less intuitive due to its squared units. In neurofeedback studies, variance might quantify the variability in EEG changes across participants following training. For example, a high variance in alpha wave power after neurofeedback might indicate that the intervention's effects vary widely among participants. Understanding variance helps researchers assess whether observed effects are consistent or heterogeneous across the sample. Standard deviation. The standard deviation is the square root of variance, expressed in the same units as the data. It is widely used in research due to its intuitive interpretation. With normally distributed datasets, about two-thirds of the data will be included in the range specified by plus one standard deviation around the mean. In neurofeedback, the standard deviation might describe the variability or dispersion in reaction time improvements among participants undergoing cognitive training protocols. For instance, a low standard deviation in reaction time improvements suggests that most participants responded similarly to the intervention, indicating consistent efficacy. Conversely, a high standard deviation might prompt further investigation into factors contributing to variability, such as differences in baseline cognitive function or adherence to training protocols. Interquartile range, IQR. The interquartile range measures the spread of the middle 50% of data points, calculated as the difference between the 25th and 75th percentiles. It is particularly useful for skewed datasets, as it is less affected by outliers. In neurofeedback research, the IQR might describe the range of symptom severity reductions in participants with traumatic brain injury. For example, if the IQR for symptom reductions spans 5 to 10 points, this indicates that most participants experienced moderate improvements. The IQR provides a clearer picture of variability than the range, especially in datasets with extreme values. Inferential statistics. Inferential statistics allow researchers to draw conclusions about a population based on sample data. Key techniques include hypothesis testing, confidence intervals, and effect size calculations. In neurofeedback research, these methods are essential for evaluating intervention efficacy and generalizing findings to broader populations. Statistical significance. Statistical significance is a cornerstone of inferential statistics, determining whether observed effects are likely due to chance or represent a true phenomenon. Researchers use p-values to assess statistical significance of difference between groups or change over time, with a common threshold being p0.05. This indicates that there is less than a 5% probability that the results or differences occurred by chance. In neurofeedback studies, statistical significance might is part of what determines whether changes in alpha wave activity after training are meaningful. For example, if a study finds a p-value of 0.03 for improvements in attention, the results are considered statistically significant. However, statistical significance alone is often regarded as the lowest bar for evaluating findings. It indicates whether an effect exists but does not completely address its magnitude or practical importance. Effect size. Effect size complements statistical significance by quantifying the magnitude of an observed effect. It provides critical information about the practical significance of results, which is particularly important in applied fields like neurofeedback. Common statistics that measures of effect size include Cohen's D, Pearson's R, and ETA-squared. For instance, in a neurofeedback study assessing reductions in anxiety, an effect size calculation might reveal that the intervention has a large effect, e.g., Cohen's D greater than 0.8. This indicates that the changes are not only statistically significant, but also clinically meaningful. Conversely, a small effect size might suggest that, while the results are significant, the intervention's practical impact is limited. Effect size is especially valuable in interpreting non-significant findings. For example, a neurofeedback protocol might yield a p-value of 0.07, not statistically significant, but show a moderate effect size. This suggests that the intervention may have potential benefits that warrant further investigation with larger sample sizes. Confidence intervals. Confidence intervals, CIs, provide a range of values within which the true value of a parameter within a population parameter is likely to fall. They offer a more nuanced interpretation of findings than p-values alone, incorporating both the estimated value and its precision. In neurofeedback research, CIs might describe the range of expected improvements in attention scores following training. For example, a 95% CI for attention improvements might range from 3 to 8 points, indicating high confidence that the true effect lies within this interval. Narrow confidence intervals suggest precise estimates, while wide intervals may indicate variability or uncertainty in the data. Conclusion: Descriptive and inferential statistics are indispensable in neurofeedback research, providing the tools to summarize data, assess variability, and draw meaningful conclusions. Measures of central tendency and variability, such as the mean, median, standard deviation, and IQR, help researchers interpret and communicate findings effectively. Inferential techniques, including statistical significance, effect size, and confidence intervals, enable rigorous evaluation of intervention efficacy and generalization of results. By applying these statistical methods rigorously and transparently, researchers can enhance the reliability and validity of neurofeedback studies, ultimately contributing to the development of effective and evidence-based interventions. Effect size and confidence intervals, in particular, ensure that findings are not only statistically robust, but also clinically relevant, advancing the field in meaningful ways. Meta-analysis. Meta-analysis is a powerful statistical method that quantitatively synthesizes results from multiple studies to draw broader conclusions about a research question or intervention. By pooling data from diverse sources, meta-analysis provides a more precise estimate of an effect size, enhances generalizability, and identifies patterns that may not be evident in individual studies. In neurofeedback research, meta-analysis has been instrumental in assessing the efficacy of interventions across varied populations and protocols. The strength of meta-analysis lies in its ability to integrate findings from studies with differing methodologies, sample sizes, and outcomes. For example, a meta-analysis on neurofeedback for ADHD might combine results from studies using different protocols, such as theta-beta ratio training or slow cortical potential (SCP) training. This comprehensive approach allows researchers to evaluate the overall effectiveness of neurofeedback while accounting for variability across studies. However, the quality of a meta-analysis depends on the rigor of the included studies, the clarity of inclusion criteria, and the transparency of data synthesis methods. Poorly conducted meta-analyses can yield misleading conclusions, emphasizing the need for stringent methodological standards. This is particularly important in neurofeedback, where variability in study design and reporting can complicate data interpretation. Key components of meta-analysis. A meta-analysis typically begins with a systematic review of the literature to identify all relevant studies. Inclusion and exclusion criteria are established to ensure the selected studies are methodologically sound and address the research question. For example, a meta-analysis on neurofeedback for anxiety might include only randomized controlled trials, RCTs, with clear outcome measures, excluding case studies or studies with insufficient data. Once studies are selected, data extraction involves recording key variables, such as sample size, intervention details, and outcome measures. Effect sizes from individual studies are then calculated and aggregated to produce a pooled effect size. This synthesis provides a summary measure of intervention efficacy, such as the average reduction in anxiety symptoms following neurofeedback. Statistical techniques, such as fixed effect or random effects models, are used to account for variability across studies. A fixed effect model assumes that all studies estimate the same underlying effect, while a random effects model accounts for heterogeneity among studies. In neurofeedback research, where protocol and population differences are common, random effects models are often preferred to provide more realistic estimates. Advantages of meta-analysis. Meta-analysis offers several advantages over individual studies or narrative reviews. By pooling data, it increases statistical power, enabling the detection of small but meaningful effects that individual studies might miss. This is particularly valuable in neurofeedback research, where sample sizes are often small, limiting the statistical power of single studies. Another advantage is the ability to explore moderators of treatment effects. Meta-analysis can examine how factors such as protocol type, session duration, or participant characteristics influence outcomes. For example, a meta-analysis might reveal that neurofeedback is more effective for younger participants or that specific protocols yield better results for anxiety than depression. Meta-analysis also provides a transparent and systematic framework for synthesizing evidence. By specifying inclusion criteria, data extraction methods, and statistical techniques, researchers can ensure their findings are reproducible and reliable. This transparency enhances the credibility of conclusions and informs evidence-based practice in neurofeedback. Challenges and limitations. Despite its strengths, meta-analysis is not without challenges. One significant limitation is the reliance on published studies, which can introduce publication bias. The file drawer effect, where studies with null or negative results are less likely to be published, skews the literature toward positive findings. In neurofeedback research, this bias might inflate efficacy estimates, presenting an overly optimistic view of intervention outcomes. For example, if several studies find no significant effects of neurofeedback for PTSD but remain unpublished, a meta-analysis including only positive studies might conclude that neurofeedback is highly effective. This highlights the importance of addressing publication bias through techniques such as funnel plots, which assess the symmetry of study effects, or fail-safe in calculations, which estimate the number of unpublished studies needed to nullify the observed effect. Another challenge is heterogeneity among studies. Variations in study design, sample characteristics, and outcome measures can complicate data synthesis and interpretation. In neurofeedback, differences in protocols such as the use of theta-beta training versus SCP training can yield disparate results, making it difficult to draw overarching conclusions. Addressing bias and enhancing rigor. To mitigate the file drawer effect and enhance the rigor of meta-analyses, researchers should prioritize comprehensive literature searches that include unpublished data, such as conference proceedings, dissertations, and preprint archives. Registering meta-analyses in platforms like Prospero ensures transparency and accountability, as researchers must predefine their methods and objectives. Including gray literature unpublished or non-peer-reviewed studies helps balance the evidence base and reduces the impact of publication bias. For example, incorporating data from unpublished neurofeedback trials can provide a more accurate estimate of treatment efficacy, ensuring that null results are not overlooked. Another strategy is subgroup analysis, which examines whether results differ across specific study characteristics. In neurofeedback, subgroup analyses might compare effects across different age groups, comorbid conditions, or protocol types, shedding light on factors that influence intervention outcomes. Applications in neurofeedback research. Meta-analysis has been pivotal in advancing neurofeedback research by synthesizing evidence across diverse studies. For instance, meta-analyses on neurofeedback for ADHD have demonstrated consistent efficacy, supporting its inclusion in clinical guidelines. These analyses have also identified moderators of treatment effects, such as session frequency and baseline EEG characteristics, informing more tailored interventions. In anxiety and depression research, meta-analyses have highlighted the potential of neurofeedback as an adjunctive treatment. By aggregating data, researchers can identify patterns that inform best practices, such as the optimal number of sessions or the most effective feedback modalities. Meta-analysis also plays a critical role in evaluating emerging applications of neurofeedback, such as its use in traumatic brain injury or autism spectrum disorder. By synthesizing preliminary evidence, meta-analyses can guide future research priorities and inform clinical decision-making. Conclusion: meta-analysis is an essential tool for synthesizing evidence, advancing research, and informing practice in neurofeedback. By pooling data from multiple studies, it provides robust estimates of treatment efficacy, identifies moderators of outcomes, and addresses variability across protocols and populations. However, challenges such as publication bias and study heterogeneity underscore the need for rigorous methodology and transparency. Addressing the file drawer effect and incorporating gray literature are critical for ensuring balanced and accurate conclusions. As neurofeedback research continues to grow, meta-analyses will remain a cornerstone of evidence-based practice, guiding the development of effective, personalized interventions and advancing the field. The clinical efficacy of established medical practices. The clinical efficacy of established medical practices is a cornerstone of evidence-based medicine, ensuring that interventions produce meaningful benefits for patients under real-world conditions. Clinical efficacy refers to the ability of a treatment or procedure to achieve its intended therapeutic effects in controlled or practical settings. However, research by Prasad and colleagues has highlighted that many conventional medical treatments, once considered effective, fail to demonstrate efficacy upon rigorous evaluation. Examples include the widespread use of vertebroplasty for osteoporotic spinal fractures and hormone replacement therapy for cardiovascular prevention in postmenopausal women. These interventions were initially adopted based on promising early evidence, but were later shown to have little or no benefit in well-conducted trials. This sobering reality underscores the importance of continually evaluating the clinical efficacy of established practices, even those that are widely accepted. For example, the persistence of ineffective treatments not only exposes patients to unnecessary risks, but also diverts resources away from interventions with proven benefits. In neurofeedback research, this principle is equally applicable. A practice may be considered clinically efficacious if it consistently improves symptoms such as anxiety, ADHD, or insomnia across diverse populations. The determination of clinical efficacy involves not only measuring specific treatment effects, but also accounting for nonspecific factors, such as the placebo effect or therapeutic alliance. By systematically evaluating these components, clinicians and researchers can ensure that established practices deliver real and measurable benefits to patients. Whereas efficacy refers to how well an intervention performs under well-controlled ideal conditions, effectiveness of an intervention has to do with its performance under real-world conditions with fewer constraints. For example, an efficacy study of neurofeedback for depression might use a highly selected subjects with depression as the only psychiatric or somatic symptom, have providers trained to a specific level, and require implementation of a highly standardized protocol. An effectiveness study, on the other hand, might include clients with comorbid conditions, a range of usual neurofeedback practitioners, allow concurrent treatment for other conditions, and use treatment as usual as the control condition. Whereas efficacy research uses the best conditions for making sure that an effect can be seen, effectiveness research exposes treatment effects to real interactions between client, provider, and healthcare system that may diminish effect magnitude. Efficacy and effectiveness research may be seen as resting on a continuum, sometimes using very similar designs, and both being necessary to understanding the degree to which a treatment works and how it produces its outcomes. Evidence hierarchies and the role of RCTs. Evidence hierarchies play a pivotal role in determining clinical efficacy, with RCTs occupying the highest tier due to their ability to minimize bias and establish causal relationships. RCTs employ randomization and control conditions to isolate the effects of an intervention, providing robust evidence for its efficacy. For established medical practices, RCTs serve as the foundation for assessing therapeutic value and informing clinical guidelines. For instance, in evaluating neurofeedback protocols for ADHD, RCTs can compare active neurofeedback training to sham feedback, ensuring that observed improvements are attributable to the intervention itself rather than nonspecific effects. Such studies provide high-quality evidence that informs practice, highlighting the importance of rigorous experimental designs in assessing efficacy. While RCTs are essential, they are not without limitations. They often prioritize internal validity over external validity, raising questions about generalizability to broader populations. Complementary approaches, such as observational studies and real-world evidence, are crucial for validating the clinical efficacy of established practices in diverse and uncontrolled settings. Non-experimental and experimental designs. Understanding research design is fundamental to interpreting the validity and applicability of scientific studies. Non-experimental designs, such as correlational and quasi-experimental approaches, involve observation without direct manipulation of variables. These methods are instrumental when ethical, logistical, or practical limitations prevent experimental manipulation. For instance, a researcher might examine the relationship between socioeconomic status and academic achievement without altering participants' incomes or schooling environments. Non-experimental designs offer insight into relationships, but lack the ability to infer causation due to inherent limitations in controlling treatment conditions and extraneous variables. In contrast, experimental designs actively manipulate independent variables, treatments, to observe their effects on dependent variables, outcomes, allowing researchers to establish causal relationships. These designs require control and randomization to minimize the influence of extraneous factors. By implementing random assignment, researchers distribute participant characteristics evenly across conditions, enhancing internal validity. For example, an experiment investigating the impact of sleep on cognitive performance might randomly assign participants to different sleep durations, independent variables, and measure task accuracy, dependent variable. Experimental designs are often considered the gold standard for testing hypotheses due to their potential to draw causal inferences. That is, a conclusion that an independent variable caused a meaningful difference in a dependent variable. Both designs serve unique roles in the scientific process. While experimental studies provide robust evidence for causation, non-experimental designs often guide hypothesis generation and exploratory analysis. These approaches complement each other in building a comprehensive understanding of complex phenomena. However, researchers must remain vigilant about the limitations inherent in each method, ensuring findings are interpreted within their proper contexts. The choice between experimental and non-experimental designs depends on research objectives, ethical considerations, and available resources. The scientific method's flexibility enables researchers to adapt their designs to study specific questions effectively. Whether using non-experimental or experimental approaches, rigor in methodology and critical evaluation of results are crucial to advancing knowledge. A clear understanding of the strengths and weaknesses of both designs empowers researchers to craft studies that yield meaningful and actionable insights. Practitioners are better able to select assessment and training methods for their clients when they understand the science that underpins clinical tools and their use. Populations, samples, and random sampling. Central to any research endeavor is the selection of participants from a larger population. A population encompasses the entire group of individuals relevant to a study, while a sample is a subset of that population. For instance, in a study on high school students' sleep patterns, the population might include all high school students in a specific country, while the sample could consist of students from a few randomly selected schools. The process of sampling is crucial for ensuring that study findings are representative and generalizable, that is, applicable to clients whose characteristics resemble those of the population from which the experimental subjects were sampled. Random sampling is a method where every member of the population has an equal chance of being selected for the study. This technique minimizes selection bias and enhances external validity by producing a sample that reflects the diversity of the population. For example, a randomized selection of participants for a study on dietary habits ensures that factors such as age, gender, and socioeconomic status are proportionately represented. This broad representation allows researchers to generalize findings with greater confidence. One of the primary advantages of random sampling is its ability to reduce sampling error, the discrepancy between the characteristics of the sample and the population. By ensuring that the sample is not skewed toward specific subgroups, researchers can attribute observed effects to the variables under investigation rather than to sample peculiarities. Additionally, random sampling facilitates replication, as other researchers can recreate the study with different samples and verify the results. While random sampling is ideal, it is not always feasible due to practical constraints like time, cost, and access to the population. In such cases, alternative methods like stratified sampling or convenience sampling may be employed, albeit with limitations. Regardless of the approach, researchers must acknowledge and address potential biases introduced during the sampling process to maintain the study's credibility. Independent, dependent, and extraneous variables. The foundation of experimental research lies in the identification and manipulation of variables. An independent variable, for, represents the factor a researcher intentionally alters to observe its impact. For instance, in a study of neurofeedback, the four could be the type of feedback provided, such as auditory or visual. The dependent variable, DV, on the other hand, is the outcome being measured, such as changes in brainwave patterns or behavioral improvements. The relationship between the four and DV forms the core of experimental inquiry, with the DV's value hypothesized to depend on changes in the four. Extraneous variables, EVs, are factors that might influence the DV but are not intentionally studied. For example, room temperature or participant mood could inadvertently affect performance in a cognitive task study. When EVs are not adequately controlled, they can lead to confounding, where the true relationship between the 4 and DV becomes obscured. A classic example is a study on the effects of exercise on weight loss, where dietary intake, and EV, could significantly alter outcomes if not accounted for. Effective research design strives to minimize the influence of EVs to maintain internal validity. Researchers employ various strategies to manage EVs, such as random assignment, matching participants on relevant characteristics, or holding conditions constant. These methods help isolate the IV's effects on the DV, enabling more precise conclusions. For instance, controlling for time of day in a memory experiment by using only one time of day for delivering the 4 and measuring the DV ensures that circadian variations do not confound results. Without such controls, differences in memory performance might be attributed to experimental conditions such as differences in timing that might make physiological rhythms overshadow the memory related for being studied. Understanding the interplay of IVs, DVs, and EVs is essential for both designing experiments and interpreting their findings. A nuanced appreciation of these elements allows researchers to critique studies rigorously and identify potential sources of bias or error. Whether evaluating published research or designing original studies, a strong grasp of variable management is indispensable to scientific integrity. Case study designs. Case study designs are an invaluable tool in research, particularly when exploring complex phenomena in depth. Unlike experimental designs that aim for generalizability across populations, case studies focus on a single unit, an individual, group, organization, or event to provide rich, detailed insights. This approach is often used in disciplines such as psychology, sociology, and education, where understanding the nuances of a case can inform broader theories or practices. For example, in neurofeedback research, a case study might document the progress of a patient with refractory epilepsy undergoing personalized neurofeedback treatment, shedding light on intervention efficacy and individual variability. The primary strength of case study designs lies in their ability to explore phenomena that are difficult to isolate or study under controlled conditions. By focusing on real-world contexts, case studies can capture the interplay of multiple variables, offering a holistic view of the subject. This depth of analysis is particularly valuable for generating hypotheses, exploring novel interventions, or illustrating complex theoretical frameworks. However, the specificity and contextual nature of case studies present limitations in terms of generalizability and causal inference. While a well-documented case study can provide compelling evidence for a phenomenon, it cannot establish causation or predict outcomes across broader populations. Despite these limitations, case studies remain a cornerstone of exploratory research, offering unique insights that often precede larger-scale investigations. Advantages and limitations of case studies. The advantages of case study designs are numerous, particularly in areas where traditional experimental approaches are impractical or unethical. One key advantage is their flexibility. Researchers can adapt their methods to fit the unique characteristics of the case, employing qualitative, quantitative, or mixed methods approaches. For instance, a neurofeedback case study might combine EEG recordings with patient interviews to capture both physiological and experiential changes. Another strength is the depth of understanding case studies provide. By focusing intensively on a single case, researchers can uncover subtle dynamics and contextual factors that might be overlooked in larger-scale studies. This depth is especially valuable in neurofeedback research, where individual differences in brain function and treatment response can significantly impact outcomes. A detailed case study might reveal how a specific protocol affects a patient with comorbid conditions, guiding more personalized interventions. Despite these strengths, case studies are not without limitations. The most significant drawback is their limited generalizability. Findings from a single case cannot be assumed to apply to other individuals or populations. For example, a neurofeedback protocol that proves effective for a single patient with PTSD might not yield similar results in other patients due to differences in baseline brain activity or trauma history. Additionally, case studies are often criticized for their susceptibility to bias. Researchers may inadvertently emphasize data that supports their hypotheses while overlooking contradictory evidence. This potential for bias underscores the importance of transparency and rigor in case study methodology, including detailed documentation and triangulation of data sources. Baselines and ABA designs. In single case and small end research, baselines play a critical role in establishing a point of comparison for evaluating treatment effects. An ABA design, which stands for baseline, A, intervention, B, and return to baseline, A, involves measuring the dependent variable during three distinct phases. The initial baseline phase documents the participant's condition prior to the introduction of the intervention. This phase is crucial for capturing the natural variability and stability of the target behavior, providing a reference point against which changes during the intervention can be compared. The second phase, intervention B, introduces the treatment or protocol, such as neurofeedback targeting specific brainwave activity. By comparing data from this phase to the baseline, researchers can evaluate whether the intervention produced measurable changes. In the final phase, the intervention is withdrawn to observe whether the dependent variable returns to baseline levels, offering further evidence for the treatment's efficacy and specificity. Baselines and ABA designs are especially valuable in neurofeedback research, where individual variability in brain function can significantly influence outcomes. For instance, a patient with chronic anxiety might show stable alpha-theta ratios during the baseline phase, followed by an increase during neurofeedback training. If these ratios return to baseline levels after the intervention is removed, the design supports a causal relationship between the neurofeedback protocol and the observed changes. A final B phase may be implemented to demonstrate that the treatment effect can be replicated, and so that the design concludes with the effects still present. Multiple baseline designs. Multiple baseline designs offer an alternative to traditional ABA designs, particularly in cases where withdrawing the intervention is unethical or when effects are not expected to return to baseline if treatment is withdrawn. Instead of introducing and removing the treatment for a single behavior, multiple baseline designs apply the intervention sequentially across different behaviors, settings, or participants. This staggered approach allows researchers to assess the treatment's effects while maintaining its benefits for the participant and demonstrate that the effect occurs only when treatment is introduced. In neurofeedback research, a multiple baseline design might involve targeting different brainwave patterns across sessions. For example, a patient with ADHD might first receive training to enhance beta waves, followed by sessions focusing on reducing theta waves. By observing changes in attention and impulse control corresponding to each phase, researchers can evaluate the specific effects of each protocol. This design is particularly valuable for clinicians in private practice, as it allows them to contribute to scientific knowledge without the constraints of a medical or university setting. By systematically documenting treatment effects across multiple baselines, private practitioners can generate robust data that inform both their practice and the broader literature. This democratization of research empowers clinicians to be active contributors to neurofeedback science, bridging the gap between practice and research. Small-end designs and single-case studies. Small-end designs and single-case studies represent variations within the broader category of case study designs. These approaches focus on a limited number of cases, often with repeated measures over time, to examine patterns and changes within individuals or groups. In neurofeedback research, small-end designs are frequently used to evaluate intervention effects in rare or heterogeneous populations, such as patients with treatment-resistant conditions. Single-case studies are particularly useful for assessing the efficacy of individualized treatments. For instance, a single-case neurofeedback study might track changes in a patient's alpha-theta ratios and corresponding anxiety symptoms over several weeks. By documenting these changes in detail, researchers can infer potential mechanisms of action, illustrate how to refine treatment protocols, and show details of how to work with clients. Small-end designs often employ experimental elements, such as multiple baseline designs or ABA reversal designs, to enhance rigor. For example, an ABA design might involve measuring a patient's baseline EEG patterns, A, introducing a neurofeedback intervention, B, and then withdrawing the intervention to observe whether changes persist, A. These designs provide a structured framework for exploring causal relationships within individual cases, offering a balance between depth and rigor. Applications in neurofeedback research. Case study designs have a long history of contributing to neurofeedback research, particularly in the early stages of protocol development and application. For example, some of the foundational work in neurofeedback for epilepsy was built on detailed case studies documenting individual patients' responses to training. These studies provided initial evidence for the efficacy of neurofeedback, paving the way for larger-scale trials. In contemporary neurofeedback research, case studies are often used to explore novel applications or populations. For instance, a case study might investigate the use of neurofeedback in a patient with autism spectrum disorder, ASD, documenting changes in behavioral and neural metrics following training. Such studies not only provide preliminary evidence for efficacy, but also highlight potential challenges and considerations for broader implementation. Case studies also play a critical role in understanding individual variability in neurofeedback outcomes. By examining how factors such as baseline EEG patterns, comorbid conditions, or adherence to training protocols influence results, researchers can refine their approaches and develop more targeted interventions. For example, a case study might reveal that a patient's adherence to neurofeedback training was influenced by their level of engagement with visual feedback, prompting researchers to explore more engaging feedback modalities. Case studies can also make a contribution to clinical practice by presenting failures of training methods that have known efficacy so that lessons can be learned for application with special cases. Triangulation and rigorous methodology. To address the limitations of case study designs, researchers often employ triangulation, a process that involves using multiple data sources, methods, or perspectives to validate findings. In neurofeedback research, triangulation might involve combining EEG data, behavioral assessments, and patient self-reports to provide a comprehensive view of treatment effects. Corroboration of improvements by multiple methods lends credence to findings. For example, a case study investigating neurofeedback for chronic pain might triangulate data from pre- and post-treatment EEG recordings, patient-reported pain levels, and functional MRI scans. By integrating these diverse data sources, researchers can strengthen the validity of their findings and reduce the influence of bias or subjective interpretation. Transparency is another critical component of rigorous case study methodology. Detailed documentation of methods, data collection procedures, and analytical approaches allows other researchers to evaluate the study's validity and replicate its findings. In neurofeedback research, transparency might involve sharing raw EEG data or providing detailed descriptions of training protocols and equipment settings. Conclusion: case study designs are a powerful tool for exploring complex phenomena in depth, particularly in fields like neurofeedback, where individual variability and contextual factors play a significant role. While they have limitations in terms of generalizability and susceptibility to bias, their flexibility and richness of detail make them an indispensable component of the research toolkit. By employing rigorous methodologies, such as triangulation and transparent reporting, researchers can maximize the value of case studies while addressing their inherent limitations. In neurofeedback, case studies have played a foundational role in advancing the field, from early explorations of efficacy to contemporary investigations of novel applications and individualized treatments. As the field of neurofeedback continues to evolve, case study designs will remain a cornerstone of research, providing the nuanced insights needed to refine protocols, explore new applications, and deepen our understanding of brain-behavior relationships. Evidence-based practice in biofeedback and neurofeedback efficacy criteria. Evidence-based practice, EBP, in biofeedback and neurofeedback relies on well-defined efficacy criteria to determine the reliability and validity of various applications. These criteria serve as benchmarks for evaluating interventions, guiding clinicians and researchers in making informed decisions about treatment options. The efficacy criteria range from the lowest level of anecdotal evidence to the highest standard of randomized controlled trial, RCT, validation, providing a structured framework for assessing interventions. These ratings are crucial in establishing neurofeedback as a legitimate and scientifically grounded practice. By adhering to these criteria, practitioners can ensure that the treatments they provide are not only safe, but also effective. Moreover, these ratings help policymakers, insurance companies, and patients understand the evidence supporting specific biofeedback and neurofeedback applications. The following explores the different levels of efficacy, their criteria, and their real-world implications. Level 1, not empirically supported. The first level, not empirically supported, represents interventions that lack scientific validation. These applications may be based on theoretical assumptions or preliminary observations in case reports that appear in non-peer-reviewed journals, but have not undergone rigorous testing. For example, a neurofeedback protocol designed for a rare neurological condition might initially fall into this category if it lacks sufficient data from controlled studies. While level 1 interventions may show promise, their use in general clinical practice requires caution. They are primarily suitable for exploratory research rather than routine treatment. Clinicians should be transparent with patients about the experimental nature of these applications and avoid making unsupported claims about their efficacy. It is incumbent on the clinician to be able to articulate the clinical reasoning they use for such interventions. Level 2, possibly efficacious. Interventions classified as possibly efficacious have demonstrated positive outcomes in at least one study without randomization or rigorous control for confounding factors. This level represents a step forward from anecdotal evidence, but lacks the robustness required for higher ratings. For example, a single-group pre-post study on neurofeedback for anxiety that shows significant symptom reduction might meet the criteria for level 2. The possibly efficacious rating highlights the need for further research. While the initial findings are encouraging, replication in more rigorous designs is essential to establish confidence in the intervention. In clinical settings, these interventions may be offered with caution, emphasizing their preliminary status. Level 3, probably efficacious. The probably efficacious rating applies to interventions supported by multiple studies with some methodological rigor, such as controlled designs without randomization. For instance, a neurofeedback protocol for ADHD showing consistent improvements across several quasi-experimental studies might achieve this rating. This level reflects moderate confidence in the intervention's efficacy. While not meeting the highest standards of evidence, these applications demonstrate promise and are often considered reasonable options in clinical practice. For example, a clinician might use a level 3 neurofeedback protocol as part of a broader treatment plan for ADHD, informing patients of its evidence base and potential benefits. Level 4, efficacious. To achieve the efficacious rating, interventions must demonstrate positive outcomes in comparison to control groups such as no treatment, alternative treatment, or sham/placebo. These studies must use rigorous methodologies, including randomization and adequate sample sizes, to establish causation. The intervention must produce better outcome than no treatment or equivalent outcome to an established treatment. For example, neurofeedback protocols targeting theta-beta ratios in ADHD have achieved level 4 by demonstrating equal efficacy to medication and RCTs at more than one research site. This rating represents a significant milestone, indicating strong evidence that the intervention produces reliable and meaningful effects. In clinical practice, level 4 interventions are considered standard treatments for the targeted condition. For instance, clinicians might confidently recommend neurofeedback for ADHD, knowing it meets the criteria for efficacious. Level 5, efficacious and specific. The highest level, efficacious and specific, requires evidence from RCTs in keeping with level 4, and additionally shows superior outcome to a credible sham control, active medication, or other treatment in at least two different research venues. For example, studies comparing active neurofeedback to sham feedback for anxiety and showing superior outcomes for the active protocol might meet this criterion. Achieving level 5 underscores the precision and reliability of an intervention. In neurofeedback, this rating signifies that the protocol's effects are directly tied to the targeted brainwave training rather than placebo effects or general therapeutic factors. This level is critical for establishing neurofeedback as a scientifically rigorous treatment option. Real-world importance of efficacy ratings. Efficacy ratings have profound implications for clinical practice, research, and policy. For clinicians, These criteria provide a framework for selecting and recommending interventions based on their evidence base. By prioritizing higher-rated treatments, clinicians can enhance patient outcomes and build trust in the therapeutic process. For researchers, the criteria guide study design and highlight areas requiring further investigation. For instance, protocols rated as possibly efficacious or probably efficacious indicate opportunities for conducting RCTs to advance the evidence base. This progression ensures that neurofeedback and biofeedback continue to evolve as evidence-based practices. In policy and reimbursement contexts, efficacy ratings influence decisions about insurance coverage and funding. Treatments with higher ratings are more likely to be supported, making it essential for practitioners to advocate for robust research that elevates the status of promising interventions. For example, demonstrating that a neurofeedback protocol meets level 5 criteria can facilitate its inclusion in clinical guidelines and insurance reimbursement policies. Conclusion: the efficacy criteria for biofeedback and neurofeedback serve as a foundation for evidence-based practice, ensuring that interventions are both scientifically validated and clinically effective. Each level of the hierarchy reflects a progression from preliminary findings to robust evidence, guiding clinicians, researchers, and policymakers in their decisions. By adhering to these criteria, the field of neurofeedback can maintain its scientific integrity, foster trust among stakeholders, and continue to expand its applications. The ultimate goal is to provide patients with interventions that are not only safe and effective, but also grounded in the highest standards of scientific evidence, advancing both the practice and perception of biofeedback and neurofeedback therapies.